All right, guys, you are locked on Falcons. I'm your host, Aaron Freeman, and today is another Q&A episode where I will be answering your listener questions dealing with the Atlanta Falcons.
You are Locked On Falcons, your daily Atlanta Falcons podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
All right, guys, you know me. I'm Aaron Freeman, been covering the Falcons for many years at FalcFans.com. On Twitter at FalcFans, and of course, I am the host of this illustrious Locked On Falcons podcast. Today is a Q&A episode where I will be answering your listener questions pertaining to the Falcons. We got some off-season questions. We got a question dealing with the draft, free agency, running back depth, changing coaching staffs, you know, roughing the passer penalties and whatnot. So those are going to be some of the questions we answer on today's episode. And if you guys want to know where you can submit your questions, your comments, your suggestions for future Q&A episodes or just in general, you can do so, of course, on Twitter. I'm at FalcFans. These better than just send it over to the show's Twitter handle, which is Locked On Falcons. The name of the Facebook page is also Locked On Falcons. You can also send an email to LockedOnFalcons@mail.com and leave a comment at FalcFans.com where the podcast is posted daily. All right, so without further ado, let's jump into these questions. The first one comes from Ganymede Whiskey Imports at Galaxy Whiskey on Twitter. Do you think having a new offensive coordinator would benefit the team next year or would lead to another two-year growth period of learning a new offense? Would you make the call to switch OCs or give Sark another year? Now, if you know, to answer this question, if you're basically saying, you know, this is an ugly metaphor, but gun to my head, I don't know which one I would choose. If it's me, Aaron Freeman, making the choice, then I would probably fire Sark with the hope of hiring someone like a Todd Monken or Gary Kubiak or John DeFilippo to replace him. If you're asking me, you know, based off of quantum leaping into Dan Quinn's body, that's a reference to an 80s and 90s television show for you young folks, then I'm probably going to keep Sark just because I'm concerned about my job security next year. I've mentioned this before, but in the Arthur Blank era since 2002, no Falcons head coach has survived two consecutive years of not making a playoff appearance. And if I'm Dan Quinn and I'm going to fire my offensive coordinator, that's potentially going to throw a wrench. That's going to be a hurdle that I'm going to have to figure out a way to overcome without that's going to potentially put me on the hot seat. And if that doesn't go according to plan, then I'm looking at potentially being axed, particularly, you know, if my offense isn't clicking, then I'm putting more pressure on my defense to have to pick up the slack, which, you know, the defense, you know, is not probably not as bad as I often crap on them on this podcast, but they're not good. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, so it's like an average defense. So I don't want to necessarily put too much stock on an average defense to have to sort of be the thing that is the consistent thing that supports the entire team. So for the sake of continuity and in the sake of hoping that with a third year and some improvements to this, maybe some of the skill positions as well as the offensive line, that Sark will be able to at least give me an offense that will at least allow me to keep my job and then get me back in the postseason where I can sort of reset the clock to the point where then I can at least buy myself two more years at the very least, presumably at that point. But who knows? Next question comes from Brian at Your Homeboy Brian on Twitter. He asks, with everything that has happened this season with Tevin Coleman's individual performance, Freeman's health being a question mark, and Ito Smith now being injured, do you think the chances of the Falcons re-signing Tevin have increased or decreased? I would say things over the course of this year have decreased. I think, you know, Coleman had the opportunity to steal Devontae Freeman's job this year with Freeman getting injured. I would have said probably going into the year that there was probably a 35 to 40% chance that the Falcons would find some way to retain Tevin Coleman. I would probably say over the first month, that percentage probably improved. Certainly Falcon fans with, you know, the Twitter takes and some media people basically saying that the Falcons should keep Coleman and try to find a way to get rid of Devontae Freeman this offseason, either trade or cutting him. That was a very popular take in September and October. That has died down since. And as it has, I think the chances of sort of Coleman being retained beyond this season has also died down. And so I would probably put that number, if I'm guesstimating again, pulling these numbers out of my butt, but I'd probably say it's like 20-25% now that the Falcons keep Coleman. But, you know, a lot of it depends on variables that we don't know right now, what the running back market is going to be. We know Le'Veon Bell is going to have really high contract demands. He's going to try to follow in the heels of guys like Todd Gurley and David Johnson to get to really reset the running back market. And whether that has a trickle-down effect to other running backs, including Tevin Coleman in the market, we'll have to see. Will that push up costs for, you know, running backs like Tevin Coleman? Or will teams purposefully, you know, quote-unquote collude and try to push down the running back market as to sort of offset the increases we've seen with guys like Gurley, Johnson, and presumably Bell this offseason? And if that's the case, then I think there's still a chance that the Falcons can manage to, 'cause I think it comes down to money. Like, I figure, like, around $5 million a year is a number that the Falcons could realistically try to keep Coleman and feel relatively justified for doing so. That's basically Duke Johnson money, but, you know, and we'll touch upon this in a moment. But, you know, the expectation is Coleman's going to want probably $7, $8 million a year or potentially more from whoever signs him. And that's probably going to price him out of the Falcons range and lead him to sign with another team. And there's more to talk about on that specific issue in just a moment. But since we are going to talk a little bit more about the offseason coming up, I should plug the two draft podcasts on the Locked On Podcast Network. First is the Locked On NFL Draft Podcast with hosts John Ledger and Trevor Sikma. The second is the Draft Dude Podcast with hosts Joe Marino and Kyle Krabs. You can find them both wherever you get your Locked On podcasts, as well as you can find their written content of those four guys, as well as several other individuals at thedraftnetwork.com. Your team every day. Tim Young has a question at DGDTim1286 on Twitter. With news about Tico getting a $30 million deal this offseason, and in parentheses, Tim says, I don't think he gets that. But if he does leave, do we go with Free and Ito or do we draft a guy? You know, this is a recent report from our good friend D-Led at the AJC. I think this is more D-Led connecting dots, more so than necessarily reporting like, oh, this is what Tevin and his agent want. This is, you know, looking at the market and seeing what Jerick McKinnon got paid last year, which was a $7.5 million over 4 years, I believe. And basically, like, that's what he's shooting for, which makes perfect sense. That's an easy dot to connect, I think. So whether or not Coleman gets that or whether he's actively seeking that remains to be seen, I think, at this point. You know, I don't think agents, you know, I'm not an agent, but I don't think agents really start talking money until February, unless, you know, unbeknownst to the rest of us, that the Falcons and Coleman have been negotiating for the last, you know, 4 or 5 months, and that was the last point where they're negotiating and they decided to part ways, where Coleman was asking for $30 million, the Falcons were offering, I don't know, $20 million or something like that. I doubt that's the case, but that's just pure speculation on my part. I've said this before, either on this podcast or another podcast I do. I don't think running back is a major issue, regardless of what Coleman does moving forward. I think, you know, once the team brought back Brian Hill, I think the Falcons basically are set at the running back position. You know, you can certainly argue it's not perfect with Freeman, Ito, and Brian Hill, but I think they're good to go. Like, I don't feel like that's a major concern. If the Falcons are going to go after a running back this offseason, in my opinion, it should be a Christian McCaffrey, Alvin Kamara type of running back that is going to be a big factor in the passing game, that can basically line up as a slot receiver or split out wide and bring something to this offense that is currently missing from the offense. That you can argue Coleman, we've dabbled with Coleman filling that role, but he hasn't, certainly under Sark, probably hasn't fulfilled that role as much as probably people would want him have to do. But unless you're fine, and again, obviously Christian McCaffrey was, what, a top 12 pick, top 10 pick. Kamara was a third-round pick that many people thought should have been a first-round pick in that year. So finding those types of players is easier said than done. So, again, unless one of those guys falls into your lap in on, say, day two or early day three, you know, I don't think the Falcons really need to worry too much about their running back depth, particularly with, you know, Hill, you know, stepping up this past week and showing his ability and potentially could show his ability again, given the injury to Coleman in this week 17 game. Our next question comes from at fan since 1988 on Twitter. He asks, if you had to rank defenders most important to the defense, how would you rank Neil Grady and Deion based on how you've seen the defense play with and without each guy? I wouldn't rank. I don't necessarily know if I would use absence as the methodology for ranking them, particularly when we have, you know, well, 2+ years for these guys to really see what they can do to the table. You know, for me, and I've said this a number of times on the podcast over the last year, I always put Neil ahead of Jones on my rankings. I think when you look at how the Falcons utilize Neil, given that he often gets the tough assignments, he often executes those assignments better than Jones does. We saw that throughout last year where in the Buffalo game where Jones was asked to spy Tyrod, he struggled in that role. Then they switched to Neil. Neil didn't miss a beat. We saw in that Week 16 matchup against the Saints, it was Neil that was often being asked to shadow Kamara. The only time we ever really saw Jones do that was that Week 17 game against Carolina where Drew McCaffrey did an excellent job against them, but that probably had a lot to do with the fact that Greg Olsen was in that game and Neil's job was tasked to shut down Greg Olsen, which he did. But, you know, you look back at this past week against Carolina, Deion Jones wasn't asked to shadow Christian McCaffrey. He probably drew the majority of the man coverage assignments against him, but there was a healthy mix of Neesman and Jordan Richards and DeMonte Casey and Foye Olukun also getting those opportunities as well, to the point that you wouldn't necessarily deem that Jones was, you know, primarily responsible with slowing down Christian McCaffrey. And it's hard to say, looking at the tape from what I saw of the All-22 and certainly live, that I would come away saying like Jones did a significantly better job than any of those other three or four guys did against McCaffrey either. So that's one of the reasons why, like, you know, Jones is always going to be at most third highest, most valuable player on this defense for me, which is lower than a lot of other people consider him to be one or two. So to me, the real question is whether I would put Neil or Jarrett number one. And I would probably argue that just off of sheer positional value, Jarrett should be number one because of his ability to play up front and be able to disrupt plays, whether it's against the run or rushing the quarterback, being able to disrupt plays before they even develop with his ability to penetrate and provide pressure or make tackles in the backfield is more valuable than what Jones is, or what Neil is asked to do, which is to disrupt plays, you know, 5 yards down the field where he's coming downhill to fit a gap in the run, or he's 10, 20 yards downfield covering a guy, whether that's in zone or man coverage. So, if I was making the argument, I'd probably put Jarrett one just because of the positional value, not to mention the fact that, you know, recency bias. The fact is that Jarrett has been number one this season and Neil has missed this season. So, you know, by default, Jarrett should get the, you know, if we're breaking a tie, Jarrett should get the tiebreaker in that case. So I'd go Jarrett one, Neil two, Jones three. Our next question comes from for EKB1 at @FirstFlight_Eli on Twitter. For the draft, I would like to see the Falcons draft Rashawn Gary, Quinnen Williams, or Ed Oliver to all play alongside Grady. What do you think the fit would be for each of them? And what do you think of them as prospects? Well, I haven't studied these guys in depth, and certainly as we get closer to April, I will put a lot more homework into them. I've watched all three guys. I watched Gary primarily over the summer, and I haven't really watched him during the season. Quinnen Williams was really on nobody's radar other than probably Alabama fans going into the season. So I've watched him over the course of the season. Ed Oliver, he's been injured this season, so I haven't really gotten an opportunity to see him play outside of a couple of cut-ups this year. But primarily it's last summer watching in last season with him. I think he is clearly below the other two, I think, as in my opinion. And I wouldn't necessarily, based off of what I've watched of him so far, I wouldn't necessarily be thrilled that he was the Falcons' top pick in this draft. I think he's a good player. I think he's a talented player. I think he's an athlete, but I think he's a little raw at this point. I think his fit in Atlanta is probably in the often discussed, over-discussed Michael Bennett role, where he plays base defensive end, which is what he plays primarily for Michigan, which is a defensive end. But most people, including myself, think he projects a little bit better as an interior guy. And then he would kick inside to be that interior guy on the nickel situations. But I think he's pretty raw at this point, and I see him more as like a mid to late first rounder than mid to early first rounder, where one assumes the Falcons will be picking. I think they're pretty much locked in to picking the top 16 and probably will wind up picking somewhere in the top 12. I don't necessarily covet Gary that highly, but we'll see. You know, from what I understand, it's not as if there is a ton of guys outside of this D-line class that deserve that type of praise, from what I've heard. I don't know, but we'll find out later. I might have a different opinion come March. Oliver, I think, is pretty raw, but I think the difference is that Oliver at least understands how to use his athleticism. I think, you know, a lot of the issues with Oliver has been sort of knocks on his size, because allegedly he has been playing sub 280 this season at Houston. He's always been a small guy. I don't think the size is as big a deal for me personally, because I think I imagine he will get up to 280 plus by the combine. And if he does, then that's not a big deal to me. You know, Babineau and Aaron Donald are guys that played primarily in the 280, 285 range. So Oliver playing in that range to me is not an obstacle to prevent him from having success in the league, particularly given that his role, similar to those two guys, is going to be as a disruptor, not as a, you know, hold the gap type of player. I think with his fit in Atlanta, and I think one of the reasons why I don't have as big an issue with his lack of size as maybe other teams would, is because the Falcons use a base versus a nickel front. They have two separate fronts based off of base and nickel situations, and Oliver will primarily be a nickel guy, and therefore the playing the run isn't nearly as important as it would be if he was going to be asked to be a every down player like he would elsewhere in the league. And also you couple that with the fact that one would hope that the Falcons offense would get back to a point where they're being able to score a lot of points, and this team will be able to play a lot more with leads, and therefore our defense can be better geared towards, you know, rushing the quarterback and defending the pass than necessarily asking it to beef up. But I certainly understand the argument that many have made, and I agree to a certain extent, that, you know, having a beefier D tackle to play opposite or play beside Grady Jarrett makes a lot of sense, if only because Deion Jones is not good at his run fits. And so therefore you want to have somebody there that can sort of keep him clean, because if he's asked to take on offensive linemen, and, you know, that's going to be problematic for him, as it has been over the last couple of seasons. So I get that argument, but at the same time, if push comes to shove, give me the best pass rusher. And if the best pass rusher is a 280-pound Ed Oliver, I'll take that over the 300-plus-pound guy who's less of a pass rusher but might be a little stouter against the run. I think the reason why people love Quinnen Williams is that he's a little bigger. He's about 295, based off of the numbers I've seen, and is a really good pass rusher. So it's not a trade off quite to the same degree that you would have, or at least the way I just framed it. So I think, you know, Williams is the best technician of the group, which is saying something, given that he's only a redshirt sophomore. And it basically has only played one season and plus as a freshman. So I think, you know, Williams at least has the ability to play in those base downs, although he probably wouldn't be asked to do so a ton, because you would have Deidre Sinnott, you have Grady Jarrett to potentially play there as well. And one would hope that the Falcons also find a way to upgrade that Terrell McClain spot, which is the three technique in the base defense beside Sinnott. This offseason, whether that's hopefully in free agency, but if that's in the draft, then so be it. Williams could sort of dabble in that role as well, but primarily he would also be a nickel guy. And as you guys know, the Falcons play nickel about 65 to 70% of the time. So that's basically the primary thing that you would want to see. And in those situations, generally speaking, you rush the quarterback about twice as much as you play the run. So there you have it. There's more to come. We got another couple of questions to answer on today's Q&A podcast, but I do want to plug the NBA side of the Locked On Podcast Network, where you can find a daily Locked On podcast devoted to all 30 NBA teams, including the Locked On Hawks podcast with host Brad Rowland. If you're tired of football, then hey, NBA season is starting to get into the swing of things, and check out Locked On Hawks, check out whatever NBA team you support. And you can find those wherever you get your Locked On podcast, your NBA team, every day. All right, our last question comes from Joshua Jonas, at JoshuaJonas96 on Twitter. He asks, explain the roughing the passer by Grady. When does the Tom Brady rule, going low on a quarterback, actually apply? Well, Joshua, I don't necessarily know. I'm no expert on the NFL rule book. Far from it. I don't necessarily want to be an expert on the NFL rulebook. I'd rather keep my brain full of who was on the 1996 Falcons than necessarily the nuances of officiating. But for at least for me, you know, I don't know if this requires a lot of explanation. At least why the refs threw the flag, in my opinion, is, you know, they threw the flag very late on the play. And I think the reason why they threw the flag is they looked down and saw Taylor Heinicke writhing on the ground in pain. And they were like, oh, maybe he's got hurt because he got hit low. And let's throw a flag and call roughing the passer. And that's basically why they did it. And, like, you can certainly disagree with the call, because I think when you look back at it, Grady Jarrett was blocked into him. And from what I understand, the rule is that if you get blocked into a guy and wind up hitting him low, it's not a flag. And I think that's initially why the refs didn't throw the flag. But then when they saw Taylor Heinicke writhing on the ground with an elbow injury, not necessarily a knee injury, but they didn't know, they were like, maybe we should protect the quarterbacks like we're supposed to and throw the flag. And I think that's what they did. So it kind of is what it is. You know, I don't think it should have been a flag, but I get why they threw the flag, you know. You know, that's the part of human error. That's the part of judgment that is the flaw in sort of, you know, until we get robots and cyborgs, you know, officiating games and probably playing the games as well. You know, that's just going to be an inherent part of the game. So, I hope that's all the explanation you needed, Joshua, because I don't know what else to, you know, I don't know the exact instances of when it's, but I do know that, like, if you get blocked into a guy, they're not supposed to throw the flag, but sometimes they do. So it is what it is. You know, look, I can't be like too, be like, oh, the league is soft and they're too sensitive about hitting quarterbacks and all that stuff. Cause I'm like, if someone did that to Matt Ryan, I'd be like, come on, man. You know, like, so it's one of those things, like, I get it. You know, it was a great play by Grady. He made a great move on Greg Van Roten with a nice swim, hit him with that nice swim move. And Van Roten, because he got worked, sort of ducked his head and sort of went down and it pulled Grady down. In the process, Grady, you know, continuing finishing the play, hit Heinicke low, and it drew a flag because Heinicke was hurt, got hurt. That's basically it. So there you have it. Those are our questions for this week. I appreciate everybody who sent them in. I appreciate everybody tuning in during this holiday season. Yeah, man, we'll be back Monday for a rapid reaction talking about this Bucks Falcons season finale. We'll probably be back Tuesday to talk about any potential changes. I don't know. Black Monday is next Monday, so maybe we'll have some news as you guys are listening to this podcast. Maybe that will be the bulk of my rapid reaction. Like, oh, I don't know. Maybe some people lost their jobs today based off of how certain units performed on Sunday against the Bucks. I don't know, guys. But, you know, we will definitely return to our normally scheduled program next week without the holidays sort of interfering with that. I hope you guys have a safe New Year. Am I going to talk to you guys before the New Year's? I don't know. Okay, I will talk to you guys before the New Year's. So, we'll talk about it later. All right. So for those of you that want to submit your questions to get answered on future Q&As, or just want to provide your feedback on what you like about the podcast or what you don't like about the podcast, you can do so on Twitter. I'm at FalcFans. If it's podcast related, just indicate so in the tweet. But if it is podcast related, just go ahead, send it over to Locked On Falcons. That's the name of the show's Twitter handle. Locked On Falcons is the name of the Facebook page where you can also submit any of your questions or comments. LockedOnFalcons@mail.com is the email address where you can be like my good friend Riley Streit and send in your very, very long-winded questions. You can also leave a comment at FalcFans.com where the podcast is posted daily. So until then, guys.
You are Locked On Falcons, your daily podcast on the Atlanta Falcons, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.